WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Would you know my name if I saw you in heaven?
Eric Clapton won 6 Grammys at this week's 35th annual ceremony, including Best Album, Single, Rock Song, Male Pop Vocal, and Rock Vocal. The winning album, Unplugged, is the soundtrack of a live MTV performance. The winning song, Tears in Heaven, is in memory of his 4-year-old son who fell to his death from an apartment window. Today we're going to hear an interview I recorded with Eric Clapton back in 1989. We discussed everything from his early years in the British blues scene to his status as one of the first guitar heroes. When he was young, he was inspired by black blues performers. He told me how he discovered their music.
When I was a little boy of about 9 years old, I think I heard a couple of records on the radio just being slotted in different variety programs that were by blues musicians from America. One was quite popular, actually, in England. It was called Whooping and Hollering by Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. And it was an instrumental thing with harmonica and guitar. And country blues, really, fast country blues. And then I heard also Big Bill Brunsey, who was quite popular in Europe during the 50s and early 60s, and a fantastic guitar player and a great folk artist, you know. And I was, I don't know why, I was immensely attracted to the sound, I was immensely attracted to the spirit of the music, and I decided to kind of examine it, investigate, and so I became a blues collector, as a, you know, buying export blues records at export shops, and I got finally into people like Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson and all of the country blues players, and that's really where I got all my influences from to begin with.
Did you teach yourself guitar?
Yes, there was no one else interested in the kind of thing I was interested in. It was a very strange, unique phenomena that I was probably one of about 4 or 5 people in England, I guess, that at the time that were interested in that particular kind of music. So it was quite lonely, but I was dedicated to it. I loved that music, and I wanted to play it.
What were some of the greatest frustrations of being self-taught?
Not really knowing that, for instance, when you pick up a 6-string guitar, and I didn't know how to tune it, you know, I mean, just basically didn't know how to tune it, and I refused, you know, I mean, a quite arrogant way to buy the books, you know, buy even those teach yourself how to play basic guitar books. So I had to learn how to tune the guitar on my own.
And those books had awful songs.
Well, yeah, that's what, you know, Old Black Joe was the kind of...
Exactly, yeah.
Obligatory kind of songs. I couldn't stand that stuff, and I refused to do it any other way but my own way. And then the next step was, once, if you considered you had got it in tune, was that if you put your fingers on different frets and then tried to make a chord, I was under the impression I was inventing all this stuff, you see, and... In actual fact, it was all being done before, but it was a great. I prefer to think of it, of doing it that way, because I felt like I was discovering it all.
You were learning the blues as a white Englishman, and you were very removed from the lives of the bluesmen whose music you were emulating. Was there an element of romance in your mind to what the blues musician's life was? And did you know anybody who was remotely like the musicians whose work you were listening to and trying to play?
I didn't know anybody at all that I could identify with in that way. But to the first part of your question was that, yes, it was incredibly romantic. I could identify in some aspects in that I came from a very poor country background. And so, I was kind of maybe like a white counterpoint of in the English South, you know, except there wasn't a racial situation at all, but we were very poor, and it was like, you know, it was. I imagine it'd be quite similar to somewhere in Mississippi. I don't know, maybe not, but I tend to identify with it in that way, and I kind of dreamt of myself being this lonesome blues singer, you know, at a very early age.
Do you remember the first time you actually performed with a black blues musician?
I think it would have been Sonny Boy Williamson. Yeah, and I was already in a professional band called the Yardbirds. I was around 18 years old, and Sonny Boy had just done a tour with the Country Blues Festival through Europe, and he decided that he would like to stay in England and make some money, because it was possible then for blues performers like himself to go through Europe and make an incredible amount of money, which more than they could dream of making in America. And the Yardbirds were somehow linked up with him through the management people to do a tour of England. And I met him and was incredibly scared of him. He was a very, very, a frightening man. A very nice man, but he had an attitude that he could adopt at any point that was really quite terrifying. Apart from that, musically, he was so inspiring that it was the first taste I had of the real thing, you know.
And what was your reaction to it?
My reaction was very mixed. First of all, I think you get into this. I was very possessive about the blues, and I thought that being that I was one of the only people playing in England, I tended to think that I owned it around that time in my life. And to meet someone who was real doing it made me feel a little bit ashamed. A little bit possessive and a little bit resentful about the whole situation, and all mixed up at the same time with overawe, you know. And the whole thing sort of seemed very bewildering to me as a phenomenon, you know. It was a bewildering experience.
You know, you use the word playing with someone who was real. It makes me think that you thought of yourself as not real, not...
Well, it was a bit of a kind of phony situation when you think about it. I was English, I was white, and I was dedicated to and playing the blues, or what I thought were the blues, but it was all in an unreal situation, and all derived from records that I bought or listening to the radio, and quite contrived, really. And I deliberately was trying to live what I assumed would be a blues man's lifestyle, you know, bumming around with a guitar on my shoulder. And to meet the real thing, who was... And see, Sonny Boy blew a lot of the myth away by being incredibly interested in money and women. And, you know, I had set myself up to think that, you know, a blues man was far, far above these kind of earthly pursuits. You know, I thought that it was much, you know, a blues man would be dedicated to his music and nothing else would matter. And it really wasn't like that at all. You know, it was all down to flashy suits and fast cars and... you know, the stuff that you like in life. And it really kind of shook me up.
So how did it change you?
Well, I guess I started to adopt a lot of those attitudes myself, you know, at a fairly early age. And musically, it meant that I had to get my act together, you know, because... I think that what happened with the Yardbirds was that I was one of the only ones that wanted to. The rest of the guys were... We were all a little bit intimidated by Sonny Boy, but I think the others were more than I was. You know, I was attracted as well as intimidated, and I wanted, after that, to carry on in that lifestyle, and that the others wanted really to go in a pop music direction.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Eric Clapton. He swept the Grammys Wednesday night with his song Tears in Heaven and his album Unplugged. Let's get back to his days with the Yardbirds. This was their first hit, For Your Love, which came out in 1965.
Dream on me at night.
You were early in your career with the group The Yardbirds and playing a mix of blues and pop, and you left the group after the band really started to get a big hit, which was For Your Love. And
yeah.
My understanding is that you left because you thought that the song was too pop and that the group was... getting more commercial and going away from its blues emphasis. I wonder what you think listening back to that record now. I mean, I think it's a really good record, whether it's whether it's blues or not.
Yeah, I think it's a good record. If I hadn't been part of the band, I thought I probably would have liked it then too, but it seemed to me a huge threat at the time. And
I thought because it was taking you away from what you wanted to do?
Well, a very big disappointment, you know, because it was kind of like going out with a girl and then finding out that, you know, that she likes, I don't know, you know, Sly Stallone when you like Robert De Niro. Do you know what I mean? It's like all your tastes suddenly start to diverge, and it was heartbreaking. It was really actually very heartbreaking, and one of the first real big disappointments in my life, because to start out with, the band was very unified in our likes and dislikes, and then I noticed that they became more kind of interested in what the, you know, Freddie and the Dreamers were wearing on stage and things like that. So, I don't know, it just really floored me, and for a while after I left that band, I really considered packing it all in because I didn't think anyone else, you know, cared about it the way I did.
What did you do when you left the band?
I went and stayed with a friend of mine in Oxford. He's a friend of mine who was a pianist first and then became a woodcarver. And he had left the band and he was carving a Tang horse as a method of sort of his way of retaliating against the rest of the band. And we sat up in Oxford and just drank wine and ate pigeon pie for about 3 or 4 months. And then John Mayall got in touch with me and asked me if I'd join his band.
Well, you joined John Mayall with the Blues Breakers, and the emphasis there really was on authenticity and on playing as closely to, you know, the blues records that inspired you as you could get. Was that a satisfying experience?
Yes, it was. I really enjoyed working with John, and I now kind of regret that I left the band so early because we'd only made one record, really, which later on seemed to become a classic, and I think it's a classic record. It would have been nice to have furthered it a bit more, and I know he'll agree with me with that, but I guess I was young and impetuous, and I wanted to go my own way. You know, I found my feet so fast with John's band that it seemed like the world was my oyster, you know.
Let's listen to one of the Blues Breakers records. My guest Eric Clapton sings and plays guitar on this one. This is the Robert Johnson song, Ramblin' on My Mind.
I'm going down to the station, cast in a fast new train to see. I'm going down to the station, cast in a fast new train to see. And the sun got the blue about me.
After the Blues Breakers with John Mayall, you formed Cream with Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker, and you've said that you liked Jack Bruce's irreverence, that you liked him for not trying to be authentic, bluesman.
Yeah, he came in from another area altogether, and he was one of the first musicians that was, and Ginger too, but Jack, in a much more easily identifiable way, was a rebel, musical rebel. You know, he came from a jazz background, and it was one of the first fusion players I'd ever met who was willing to cross jazz into blues and rock and roll all at the same time. He didn't see that there was a musical boundary, and he was a very intellectual, one of the first musical intellectuals that I met. He was deeply into classical music and modern classical music at that, and I was for quite a while under Jack's spell, because he seemed to me to have, you know, the most unique and avant-garde attitude towards music that I'd ever met.
What did Cream bring out in your playing that you hadn't expressed before?
freedom, I think. During the time that I was with Cream, I was constantly being urged by Jack and Ginger to kind of throw off all of my inhibitions that I'd spent years honing with the Blues Breakers, for instance, and my blues rule book was supposed to be going out the window, and it often did. You know, when we played live more than any other time, we would simply just improvise, and it would be very hard for me, more than anyone else, to really get rid of my idea of frameworks and structures. You know, I was really the last one to be able to let go of the things that I'd been using to hold me down up until then.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Eric Clapton. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Eric Clapton won 6 Grammys Wednesday night, so we're rebroadcasting an interview I did with him 3 years ago. Here he is with Cream, jamming on Crossroads, the Robert Johnson blues classic that Cream turned into a rock hit. What was it like for you to learn to take sustained solos in concerts? Were you used to doing that before Cream?
Yes, I think we did it with... I think John would encourage me to play as long as I liked, but I had a much more controlled idea about what it should be then. With Cream, it came out of a very basic kind of necessity situation. The first gig we ever played at a big jazz festival in England, we ran out of material after about an hour, and the crowd wanted more, and they weren't going to give up, and so we literally had to go and jam, and we found that became the most popular part of our act, was when we didn't have anything set to play, and we would just play off the top of our heads, and it worked. A lot of the time it really worked.
I'm wondering if there were times at concerts when everyone in the band was really high and nearly everybody in the audience was really high, and it would lead to this almost self-indulgent, you know, length in solos. Did you ever feel that way?
Yeah, I can remember playing at the Fillmore many times, at Fillmore West, when, you know, it was just like being in someone's front room with everyone smashed out of their brains listening to the stereo, and we were the stereo, really.
So was that a good feeling or an alienating feeling?
Well, I'm not going to pretend it was anything but great.
Okay,
I thought it was fantastic.
My guest is Eric Clapton. Why don't we listen to the opening of one of Cream's best-known records?
I'll soon be with you, my love. Give you my dull surprise.
On something like Sunshine of Your Love, which has this now really famous opening lick, do you consider that part of the composition, or is that something that was added afterwards, and who came up with that?
Well, that's Jack. We went to see Jimi Hendrix. Jimmy was a dear friend of ours, and this was like 1967. There was a theater in London called the Savile Theater where everyone at the time was playing, and we went to see Jimmy play there, and Jack and I were in a box looking down, and I think it was the first time Jack had really listened to Jimmy properly, you know, and he was overwhelmed, and that night he went home and wrote that riff, and the song was actually written on the riff. It wasn't added, you know, it was the other way around from the way that you think. You know, we didn't add the riff to the song. We added the song to the riff.
And Crossroads, which is one of the Cream records that I think you must have initiated. It's a Robert Johnson song that I'm sure it was you who decided to record. You do the vocal on it. It was one of the few Cream records that you were the solo singer on.
Yeah.
Tell me why you wanted to record that.
I'd had the Robert Johnson album for many years by then, and I was pretty well familiar with all of the songs on there, and I thought that was the best one. I mean, I always wanted to do Robert Johnson's songs In different... I mean, the first one I did was with John Mayall. I did Rambling on My Mind.
Which you sang also, yeah.
Yeah, and then... But then with Cream, each time we made a record, I would find some way of arranging a Robert Johnson song to put on there. But Crossroads, to me, was the one that summed up... I didn't know it then, but I guess it must have summed me up in many ways, but it summed up Robert Johnson's story, you know.
How do you think it summed up your story?
Because I've been at that crossroads many times in my life, in many different ways, musically, personally, business-wise, just geographically. I'm often at that place, and I kind of follow my own nose. I don't really know where I'm going a lot of the time.
What did the whole Clapton is God period have on you? What effect did it have on you when people were writing that kind of graffiti on walls?
Well, I don't think I actually ever saw it. You know, isn't that the funny thing? I don't think...
Is this all apocryphal? I mean, I can swear I've seen it.
I've only ever heard it said, and I've seen a picture of a wall in London. And it's a funny picture. There's this brick wall in London with Clapton is God written on it in white, chalk or paint, I don't know what. And at the bottom of the picture, there's a dog peeing against the wall. You know? And that kind of sums up my attitude towards it. But I don't think I've ever actually seen it in the flesh. So it's all something that I've had to accept from other people. And as far as that goes, it's a bit like someone kind of paying you the highest compliment they can think of. And in that respect, I've tried to learn to accept it graciously.
Mm-hmm.
First of in the early days, I would just I was thoroughly disgusted with the whole thing. But as time has gone by, I've learned to say thank you.
Eric Clapton recorded on Fresh Air in 1989. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air, and we'll be back with more from Eric Clapton in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air. When Eric Clapton walked away with 6 Grammys this week, we decided to feature our 1989 interview with him. Clapton is one of rock's first guitar heroes and godfather to many heavy metal bands, but his award-winning album Unplugged is an acoustic concert originally broadcast on MTV. This second part of our interview begins with his last days in Cream, the band he formed in the mid-60s with bassist and singer Jack Bruce and drummer Ginger Baker. Let's get back to our 1989 interview. A couple of years ago, you did an interview with Robert Palmer for, I guess it was in the New York Times. Maybe it was in Rolling Stone. New York Times? Okay. And you had told him that John Landau had written a review of a Cream concert.
That's right.
And he gave it a really bad review. And you said that the Ring of Truth knocked you backwards, and that's when you decided that you wanted to leave Cream. Why did that review have such a profound effect on you?
Well, it was tied in with a long, in-depth interview which I had done in Sausalito. If my memory serves me right, I had been flying high, and we'd been playing the film all West stoned and everything. And really, we were God's gift to music, you know, and I was blathering on about all this. And on the next page was this fantastic review, and I was summed up as being the master of the cliché. And juxtaposed with this interview, the effect was astonishing. And I remember reading the article in a restaurant. I was with some friends in Boston, and I read the whole thing in silence, and the other guys were just sitting around having a conversation. I stood up to go to the loo and passed out. I mean, it had that severe. And I remember waking up, not coming around in the restaurant. I was taken, carried out of the restaurant and put in someone's house. I'm waking up thinking, what the hell is going on? And immediately thinking, I've got to get out of this. You know, that whole thing was right. And I've been playing this awful game, a musical game, for too long, and I've got to leave that band and this and that and plan a new life. It had a devastating effect on me.
Was it because you were embarrassed, insulted, or because you felt that you needed to be moving in a new musical direction?
The last part is what... I mean, I was ashamed because I think inside I had known for quite a while that we were really... we were selling the audiences short, you know. We were going on stage stoned and we were playing just kind of meaningless... a lot of the time, anyway, meaningless, endless solos, and people were swallowing it. And I was starting to feel rather ashamed of the whole thing because we were resting on our laurels, to say the least. You know, we weren't sitting down thinking about new ways to to write songs or developing the music of the band. We had got stuck in a rut by that point.
Mm-hmm. So you did leave Cream because of that?
Yes, I did. I mean, I said to the guys, I've got to leave. You know, I've got to do something else or just stop. You know, I don't want to do this anymore. And I think we'd approached this situation for other reasons before. You know, we were constantly having rows about one thing or another. And then we talked to the manager about it, and he decided we should do one farewell tour, you know, and make a farewell album, which is what we did. And at that point, actually, funnily enough, as it does happen in many other walks of life, we became suddenly very much closer. And I think during the farewell concert we did at the Albert Hall, there was a great deal of regret and nostalgia on my part, and I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing.
Looking back, what do you think?
Yes, I think now, after all this time, I think I had a lot of other things to do that I couldn't have done if I'd stayed with that band.
You, not too long after that, I guess, formed Blind Faith. I think for the first Blind Faith concert, there was like an audience of 36,000. What was it like for you to go from starting off playing in small clubs and ending up playing these huge concerts, you know, stadium concerts? It's quite a transition, and it was right at the very beginning of that period where concerts got that big. I mean, so it's not something you could have been expecting.
I think we were sort of lulled into a full sense of security there. I think we assumed that this particular concert we did was going to be a one-off, you know, then we would go back to clubs, or at least it would be interspersed, you know. We were probably going to do, in our minds anyway, you know, big halls now and then mainly clubs. But of course, halfway through the American tour, the whole thing started to get very jaded because we were only playing stadiums and we weren't ready. We had barely enough material to do, you know, an hour and a half. And outside of that, we were empty, you know, and that wasn't the way it wanted to be. We wanted to be, at least Steve Winwood and myself, wanted to be like a very integral band that could play for hours, you know, mm-hmm. and learn lots of songs and just have a whole wealth of material, something that you would take years to develop. And, of course, we never were given that chance.
You eventually took a hiatus from music, and you spent a couple of years doing a lot of drugs.
Yeah, basically doing a lot of drugs. Yeah, I think I can't remember where it started. I've always been I've always had a leaning towards addictions, you know, one way or another. An obsessive personality, to say the least. And even when I was 16, everyone, in fact, it was like peer pressure. Everyone was taking amphetamine or different kind, or drinking wine. You know, it was part of life, it seemed to be, to get stoned. And I realized now that I was going to end up, you know, on the heap. And I pretty well got close to that. And during the early 70s, I got as close to killing myself with drugs as I could ever get. And it started out the way it always starts out, you know, smoking a joint or taking a few pills. And for some people, it escalates very quick. For me, it took a long time, but I got there, and I diced with death for a while, and I regret it. That's for sure.
Did you have like a bottoming out moment where you figured, "This is it. I've got to change"?
Yeah, I think it's funny because it's difficult to be. I mean, when you are that stoned, it's difficult to be. To stand outside of yourself and see how far you've gone, you know, because you're so wrapped up in it. Other people can tell you, but it's very difficult for you to see yourself. And it happened to me at some point. I'd had friends come and stay with me, and they were virtually like my jailers, you know. They were making sure that I didn't harm myself. I was taking lots of heroin. I was taking Mandrax, which is a powerful, like a Quaalude equivalent. I was drinking lots of hard liquor. And at some point, I remember seeing myself, and this is true, sitting in my car at dawn, totally naked, trying to start it. And what I was doing, I was trying to escape from my own house where these people were trying to look after me. And thank God, one of the guys had taken out the rotor arm of the engine, and I was just sitting there trying to start the car, totally naked. I don't know where I was going to go, but I had a flash then that things had gone a little too far. So that was when I decided to kind of start doing something about it.
And what did you do?
I went to an acupuncturist who had set up a practice in London using a fairly revolutionary form of treatment whereby she passed a small electric current from one ear to the other and induced a sort of a mild natural narcosis, which took away the withdrawal symptoms which you get when you're trying to stop taking heroin.
Mm-hmm.
The point was, of course, that I hadn't actually used it. I'd never taken heroin intravenously, so it wasn't that hard a habit for me to kick. It was quite hard, but I did it with the help of this acupuncturist.
Did you ever think that an addiction to drugs, an obsession with drugs, is kind of related to, in a way, the same kind of obsession that allows you to spend as many hours as you must have developing your guitar playing? Do you know what I mean? Because you've been obsessive about guitar playing and about your music.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I like to think of my guitar, my love for guitar playing, as being dedicated. But it's not far removed from being obsessive. I mean, there's a fine line between those two words. And what happened when I became obsessed with drug taking was that obviously my guitar playing took second place. And, you know, one is a natural kind of dedication and the other one is a very unnatural dedication.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I want to ask you something about your past, about your very beginnings, actually. I know you've talked about this, that your mother had you, she wasn't married, and she left, I think, shortly after you were born, and you were brought up by your grandparents, who told you that they were actually your parents, and when your mother returned, you were told at first that she was your sister. And I'm wondering what effects you think that had on your public identity, do you know what I mean, on your public sense of self,
It's very complicated, isn't it? I mean, whatever the result was, has to be a complicated result, isn't it, when you think about it? I've got so many different sides of my nature as a result of that upbringing. I mean, I think there's a side of me that, you know, dreads rejection, dreads abandonment. There's another side that sort of loves solitude. And I don't know, it's had all kinds of effects on me. Most of which I've kind of started to deal with over the last few years and come to terms with. And if I can, I change parts of my personality that cause me difficulty, or I at least accept them. But for sure, it was an unusual upbringing, you know.
Is your mother still alive?
Yes, she is, and we're great pals. We're more like brother and sister than anything else because she's... You know, she's not that much older than me because she was, when I was born, she was 15. And so really the age difference isn't that much. And because we didn't spend time as mother and son when I was young, we're family members, but it's almost difficult to say what kind of family members we are.
Do you call her Mom?
Yeah, I do. I call her Ma, but then sometimes I call her Pat too, which is her name. And It's a funny situation. It's a very loving situation, and it's finally come full circle to where everyone is kind of relaxed about it now.
Mm-hmm. You said that at some point in your career that you got bored with virtuoso musicianship. What was the turning point for you?
Well, I think that might have been a very glib way for me to say that I couldn't get it any better. I actually had reached the end of my capabilities, I think. And a lot of people were taking it further on, so I suppose I had to develop some kind of attitude about it, and it was probably better off for my face to say that I was getting bored, you know.
So after you felt you couldn't take it any further, you wanted to turn to something else?
No, I just realized that technically my potential was probably had come to its end, you know. I'm not that nimble, really. I don't think I can compete on the sort of the fast, furious guitar sort of championships. So I tended to go the other way.
By going the other way, you mean singing more?
Yeah, singing more, or just kind of refining my technique to somewhere where I could simplify it and get more out of it.
I got
with doing less, you know.
Eric Clapton recorded in 1989. He swept the Grammys this week with his album Unplugged and his song Tears in Heaven. This is Fresh Air.